there before.
You will too. It was clear from her body language and tone that Patty was done talking. She insisted on giving them a bag of muffins and brownies to take with them as they left. They stepped back out into the muggy night. The picnic had fizzled while they were inside. The food trucks were gone, and the square had mostly emptied out. Stevie could make out Carson, sitting alone at a table under the marquee, looking at his phone. A queasy feeling came over her, the burning shame of Allison's upset. Somehow, she had to manage this situation. The case, Carson, the feelings that were barely under the surface. The pain was so immediate for Allison and Patty. The past was not in the past for them, not really. The emotional current was alive and well, and the questions still lingered in the air. She looked down the street at the peaceful storefronts of Barlow Corners. This really was the perfect small town, with flower baskets hanging from the lampposts, everything tidy and quaint. She felt an internal quiver again, but this time it wasn't anxiety. It was something akin to excitement, edged with fear. As long as the case was unsolved, the phantom that haunted Barlow Corners remained. Restless, waiting for someone to dispel it. As stupid as she felt being connected to Carson, maybe she really could be the one to bring this to a close. Now Carson was up on his feet, and he was doing yoga by himself in the empty tent. Stevie's confidence vanished as soon as it had come. She was a teenager, saddled with a tech bro, trying to solve something she knew little about. 9.
So, Nate said, what did we learn from tonight, class?
They were back at camp, sitting on the gently bobbing dock, watching the moonlight spill over the water. They had a second dinner of brownies and muffins while millions of mosquitoes descended upon them, despite the best efforts of Janelle and her many sprays.
Well, Stevie said, brushing one from her arm, people don't love it when you come to town saying you want to donate a library, and then they find out that you actually want to make a podcast about a local tragedy.
Very good. And what did you learn, Janelle?
Janelle looked up from her phone. She had been texting with Vi. Stevie could tell this without seeing the texts, because Janelle had a particular expression when communicating with Vi. A focus, but also a softness. Her shoulders dropped.
That people love to put up statues of people who owned other people, she said. This guy, John Barlow, I just looked him up. He had 8 enslaved people on his property. 8. And he has a statue.
Oh, not texting with Vi then. Stevie was way off.
So what happens now? Nate asked. Do you think this whole thing is still going to happen? Mr. Think Jams isn't going to be put off by criticism or public scorn, but I don't know what that means for the podcast or whatever he's doing.
I think people are going to be pissed, Stevie said. But I think it will still happen.
It also sounds like Todd Cooper killed Michael Penhale. That's a pretty good motive for wanting him dead. But it doesn't make any sense to punish him for killing an innocent kid by killing 3 other innocent people along with him.
Does it need to make sense? Janelle asked. Does sense matter in murder?
Not always, Stevie said. But I think it does when you have one this carefully planned. Someone researched the woodsman. Someone brought supplies. Someone chased Eric Wilde through the woods for miles. Why do all of that if you just wanted Todd Cooper dead? There was no answer to this question.
You know what Patty is, right?
Nate said after a moment.
It just hit me. She's the final girl. That's what you call the survivor in horror movies. It's almost always a girl, and...
Nate, Janelle said.
No, hear me out. This whole thing is ticking a lot of the horror movie boxes. Murder at a sleepaway camp. A serial killer. A final girl. A kid who died because some teenagers were being irresponsible.
But this is real, Janelle said.
I'm not denying that, Nate replied. I'm just telling you the tropes.
Does this mean you know who did it? Stevie asked.
Jason Voorhees, and like I said before, he lives in a lake, and he's been to space.
They let this profound insight linger in the space between the moon and the surface of the water. A gentle drizzle began to fall, and there was a rumble of thunder in the distance. We should probably go inside before it pours, Janelle said. The trio walked up the dock and back into the campgrounds. Stevie and Janelle walked Nate to the treehouse, then continued on to their cabin behind the art pavilion. Stevie had become accustomed to the dark of the woods at Ellingham Academy. Winter nights in the mountains of Vermont are very long and very dark indeed. But at Ellingham, there were always lights in the windows or a fire in the hearth. And the walls of the buildings were made of brick and stone, built to keep out the elements. Here at the camp, the veil between the outside and the inside was much thinner. There was a thick moistness to the air, gluing everything together. And, of course, these were murder woods. Stevie shook off the thought and followed Janelle inside their cabin. There was one overhead lamp inside, which seemed to cast more shadow than glow. They each had a small reading lamp at their bedside. It wasn't a lot of light. They set to work unpacking and setting up their cabin. Janelle removed a stack of citronella candles from one of her bags and began placing them around the room in what seemed to be a ritualistic fashion, though they were more likely to be in the places insects could access the bunk, including under the screen with the hole in it. Stevie arranged her medications on the top of her bureau. She had learned from her Ellingham experience that sometimes she needed something to help her rest when she was in a new place or things were especially stressful. She took a pill, washing it down with the warm remains of soda in the can. She dumped her suitcase out onto her bed and shuffled through the contents, stuffing them in drawers. Janelle opened the drawers of her dresser one by one, testing them for sturdiness and sniffing them. "These can use some freshening up," she said. "I'm letting these air out overnight. Tomorrow I'll make some scented liners."
"You can make scented liners?" Stevie asked.
Janelle looked at Stevie as if she had asked her if she could spell her own name.
"I couldn't bring my full tool bench with me or my sewing machine, but I figured since we have a whole art pavilion to use, that would be okay."
Janelle sat on the edge of her bed.
"I'm tired," she said. "Today was weird."
Stevie nodded in agreement. They changed for bed and lay down to rest. Janelle cracked open her computer, and Stevie got out her tablet. Outside, there was the chirp of cicadas and the occasional hoot of an owl. They cranked the fan on high, but it barely penetrated the thick air. The rain began to fall in earnest, a fresh summer rain that turned up the soil and drummed on the roof of the cabin. There was low, rolling thunder. The air was sweet with ozone and earth. Carson had sent Stevie his entire collection of files on the case. There were over 800 documents organized by subjects like suspects, crime scene, articles. She scanned through these, then opened one of the excerpts in the file marked Sabrina. It was from a book on the case. "Of the four victims that night, Sabrina Abbott's presence in the woods is the hardest to explain." Sabrina Abbott was born in 1960 to the town dentist, Dr. James Abbott, and his wife, Cindy. Cindy Abbott was a self-described homemaker, and the Abbott household had a squeaky clean feel to it. Theirs was a house where there was always a casserole or a pie in the oven, where Mrs. Abbott did the dusting and the grocery shopping while Dr. Abbott saw patients. Sabrina and her younger sister, Allison, played horseshoes together in their large backyard. Allison was 12 when her 18-year-old sister graduated high school. They'd roller skate together in the street or at the local rink. "Even though I was younger, she never complained about having me around," she said. "Sabrina loved me. She let me come into her room whenever I wanted. She helped me with my homework. She was the perfect older sister, and I worshipped her. I really did." Perfect is a word often applied to Sabrina. Sabrina was at the top of the graduating class of Liberty High in 1978 and was valedictorian. She had an unbroken 4.0 grade point average, was a highly proficient pianist, and was the editor-in-chief of the Liberty High School newspaper, The Trumpet. On weekends, she volunteered at the local library, reading to small children. She was the kind of person the teachers could count on to take tests down to the office, or to watch over a class for a moment. Sabrina was never known to say an unkind word about anyone. She was the quintessential goody-two-shoes, but seemed to have been widely liked. Her boyfriend for most of high school, Sean Greenvale, was a similarly dedicated student, though his accomplishments were not as great as Sabrina's. At Liberty High, Sabrina was known for being talented at everything and for being good in general. She set the tablet down and stared up at the ceiling for a moment.
"You okay?" Janelle asked.
"Yeah," Stevie said. "It's just..." The Ellingham case felt really far away. It was really far away. There was no one left to... Stevie couldn't quite finish the thought, so Janelle stepped in.
"Feel any pain?"
"Yeah. Allison is still so raw. It's never stopped for her. And here I am. I'm at this camp trying to work it out. Do I have any right to do that?" Janelle considered this for a moment as the rain strummed its fingers on the roof.
"I think it's good that you're wondering that," she said after a moment. "It means you know where your priorities are.
You are also the person who worked out what happened at Ellingham Academy in 1936.
"Am I?"
"Yeah.
You really are.
So why do I feel like a fake?"
"Because most people feel like fakes," Janelle replied. "Imposter syndrome, it's a thing.
Do you ever feel that way?" Janelle considered this.
"No," she said. "But what I do is different. I make things. If they work, I can see them work. If they don't work, I take them apart until they do. I have science on my side."
"You're making things you can't see." It was good to have smart friends.
"The only times I feel it are when I think about Vi," Janelle said. Not
about us. But now that they're so far away, I can't think sometimes. I only think about them. I think about the next text message, the next chat, the next picture. I should be more serious. I should be thinking about my project for next year or college. And I am. But then I check my phone to see if they texted.
"Isn't that normal?" Stevie said.
"I guess. But I don't want to be normal."
"You love Vi," Stevie said.
"Yeah, I do."
"And Vi loves you."
"Yeah,"
Janelle said with a little sigh.
"They do.
So I guess you have to ride it out."
I want Vi here. Vietnam is too far. September is too far."
A silence settled over them, full of rain.
"Can you imagine how much Nate would hate this conversation?" Stevie finally said.
Janelle's laughter rang out like a bell.
"I'm going to put my headphones in," she said. "I listen to music to go to sleep."
She switched out her light, and after a moment, Stevie did the same. For the first time in months, Stevie felt complete again. She was working a case. She was with her friends. Janelle was breathing gently in her sleep. The fan ticked away like a heartbeat. For a few moments, her mind swirled with the faces of the victims of the box in the woods. Sabrina, Eric, Todd, and Diane. The raven-haired girl. The boy with the blonde curls. The guy with the light brown shag. The redhead with the long, straight hair and all the freckles. They had been here all those years ago. Slept in this place. Whatever happened to them, the answer was here somewhere. She would find it. She would pin it down. She would. She slipped into sleep with the images still flowing through her mind, blending with the sound of the rain. She stirred only to swipe away some insect that was trying to fly up her nose. The next thing she was aware of was Janelle yelling her name. Stevie blinked awake. It was a moist, almost sweaty dawn, A soft light came in from around the edges of the curtain, and Janelle was standing by the bed, gazing in Stevie's direction in horror. Stevie pressed herself upright in a second to face her friend, her heart already racing.
What? Are you okay? What?
Janelle pointed at the wall above Stevie's bed. Stevie craned around, then jumped up when she saw what Janelle was indicating. About 4 feet above where Stevie had been sleeping was the word surprise. July 11th, 1978, 9:30 p.m. When the gathering in the center of town disbanded, the adults and the younger children all retired to their homes, to their television sets and bedrooms, to safety, to normality. But in the middle of the town, the teenagers, the ones who had come closest to the beast, they were awake. They needed their own gathering, one that wasn't powered by Jell-O salads and burgers and polite talk. The parents of Barlow Corners allowed them to go, but only in groups, and only if they promised not to leave the football field. Because if they did not let them go, they would find another way. They would sneak into the woods to talk. Better to let them go as a group, in the open seclusion of the field where no one could sneak up on them. So they gathered, coming from dozens of cars in the parking lot. Some arrived singly and others in groups. Someone went into the school and switched some of the outside lights on, but these did not penetrate the middle of the field. All around, the dark curtain of the woods penned them in. Everyone knew what had happened, and yet no one knew what had happened. Just enough information had leaked to make a mess of the facts. As the days wore on, the story had whipped around in ever wider loops, taking on new and strange qualities with every pass. You could hear all these stories passing from one person to another. I heard all their fingers were cut off. There was a message written in blood on a tree.
I heard they found Sabrina's head in a McDonald's bag.
Patty Horn had come with three other girls. They had been dropped off by her friend Candace's father, who leaned against the hood of his car and watched them. Because Patty had been close to the victims, she had pride of place at this strange gathering. She sat, the understood queen of a large circle of people who spoke quietly and looked respectfully in her direction.
What about Sean? She heard someone say. He was freaked out about Sabrina. I bet he did it. He's not even here.
Was this how it was going to be? People talking about severed heads and fingers and guessing who may have done it?
Apparently.
Candace passed her a cigarette and she accepted it. She reached into her fringed purse for some matches. Look how normal it all was, sitting here in her flip-flops and her yellow halter top and white shorts, getting grass stains on her ass and mosquito bites on her arms, smoking and talking with everyone from Liberty High here in the dark. What was real, even? Then she saw a figure approaching, one she had been expecting. Greg Dempsey, her boyfriend. His dark, shaggy hair was blown all over, which meant he had come on his motorcycle. He wore cutoffs and a beat-up Led Zeppelin t-shirt. That felt like a tribute to Diane, who'd loved the band with all her heart and soul. Without a word, the group all shifted to make space for him next to Patty. He opened the bag he was carrying and pulled out a six-pack of Miller beer and cracked one open for himself, leaving the rest in the grass, an open invitation to Patty and really no one else.
Your dad here?
He asked.
No, he's still working with the cops.
Doing what?
Patrolling or something.
Patty's father was a little older than most of her friend's parents. He was one of the town's illustrious war heroes. No one ever talked about it, but everyone knew that Mr. Horn had been a spy or something. He wasn't a cop, but he was the kind of heavy guy who could help out when you were looking for a murderer. The town had a posse now, rolling slowly through the streets, watching the darkness at the edge of the woods.
You want to get out of here?
Greg said quietly.
Not allowed, she said, nodding to Candace's father. He's watching, and he's taken us home at 11.
Who cares? Let's go.
Seriously, she said. Greg shook his head. He was almost 19 now, and out of high school. He had never really answered to his parents before, and he definitely didn't now. He shook his head and reached into his pocket, producing a handful of joints.
Last once, he said. Last of Diane's rolls.
Candace looked over at Greg as he lit one of the joints.
They're watching, she said, indicating the cars and silent forms of the parents on the edge of the field.
So, they can't see? Looks like a cigarette.
What if they smell it?
Greg took a long drag and passed it to Patty, who declined. Greg exhaled hard.
So is this how it is now?
He said.
Who cares what they see?
If my dad saw me with a joint, he wouldn't pay for my college,
Candace replied. He looked to Patty for an answer.
You're not going to college, he said. What's your excuse?
Excuse? I live with him.
For now, are you going to live with Daddy forever? Do what he says?
Until I get my own place.
Greg let out a short laugh.
When are you going to get your own place?
Patty looked down. She had no plan, really. It was possible that, yes, she would live with her father forever and do what he said. She hadn't thought about what would happen to her life much beyond this summer. And now this summer, while not over, was forever changed. Life would be different now. An uncomfortable silence fell as the joint made its way around the circle. Greg pounded the rest of the beer and opened a second.
They think maybe it had to do with drugs, Candace finally said. That's what we were talking about before. Whoever Eric was buying from must have done it.
Greg said nothing.
You were selling before Eric, Candace said.
Yeah.
So who were you buying from?
That's not important, Greg said.
Patty plucked some blades of grass and crushed them between her fingers. But they think maybe that's who did it, she said to her boyfriend.
That's not who did it.
How do you know?
Because I know, Greg snapped.
How can you know?
The rest of the group fell into wide-eyed silence, and there was a general quieting all around.
This is bullshit, Greg said.
He dropped what was left of the joint into the beer can and stood up to leave. Patty jumped up as well and followed him toward the parking lot. Greg had parked his motorcycle at the end, as far away from the parents as he could, leaving them a long walk.
Hey,
Patty said.
Hey!
He stopped and turned.
I'm not doing this,
he said. He had that tone he got when he wasn't quite sober, a random loudness.
My friends are dead, she yelled. And you're being an asshole.
Our friends,
he shot back.
God, you're always like this.
Like what? You're the one who hooked up with Sabrina. You cheated on me.
He muttered something under his breath and got on his bike.
Greg!
She screamed. She was losing it. It was all too much. Hot tears burned in her eyes.
Greg, don't! You're drunk!
He revved the engine to drown out her yelling and made to pull out. She stood in the way of the bike, so he walked it backward and turned out of the parking lot. She ran after the departing bike, yelling his name. She followed him all the way to where the parking lot met the road, crying and waving her flashlight. By now, everyone around was staring as she watched his bike disappear into the darkness. Greg was barely a mile away when he left the road and went right into the trees and a wall of rock.
10. What the hell?
Janelle said.
The hell?
It was a good question. Stevie turned first to the door, which was shut. She walked over and rattled it. It was still locked from the inside. She went over to the window, stepping onto a chair to examine it. The screen and the internal safety grate were intact. There was nowhere for someone to be, but they still looked under the beds. Janelle examined the screws of the window guards up close and found that they were tight, and that there would be no way to remove or replace them from outside. Since the cabin sat on a concrete base, there was no way to come from under the cabin. The only thing that was even slightly open was a small hole in the screen, maybe an inch and a half in diameter, which was large enough to let in the mosquitoes, but certainly not large enough to allow a person through. In short, someone had done the impossible. They sat on the cold concrete floor and looked at each other.
"Well," Stevie said, "someone's been reading about me."
Not long after Stevie had arrived at Ellingham Academy and announced that she would be working on the long, cold Ellingham murder case, someone projected an image onto the wall of her room in the middle of the night, a terrifying version of the truly devious letter, but rewritten to reference Stevie. Stevie had long kept this to herself, with only Janelle and David knowing most of the details. But after the case was over and Stevie was getting press, she had talked about it with Jermaine Batt, Ellingham's resident student journalist. Jermaine had helped Stevie solve the case, and Stevie owed her an exclusive. So someone knew about messages appearing on Stevie's bedroom wall at night.
"But that one was projected," Janelle said. "That's paint. Someone painted our wall while we slept when there was no way in."
"So what does that mean?" Stevie asked. "It means it didn't happen."
"But it did happen."
"No," Stevie said. "It means that there's a message on our wall now, but it had to have been there before we came in last night, because there's no other way it could have gotten there."
"It wasn't there," Janelle said. "We would have seen it."
"How can you make something like that appear?"
Janelle fell silent in thought for a moment, then got up and returned to the wall. She climbed up on Stevie's bed and examined the word up close, scratching at it with her nail and testing the residue with the tip of a finger.
"That's really dry," she said. "No tackiness to it at all. There are paints that go on one color and dry another, but say that someone came in when we were out at the picnic and painted that on the wall. One, we would have smelled it. Paint stinks. And two, we were still awake for a while and paint dries quickly, at least initially. I don't think it would be that dry, though."
Stevie stood up and faced the wall. It wasn't that Stevie had no fears. Stevie had a lot of fears and anxieties. There had been times when they had ruled her life. Someone was playing a game. Someone had presented her with a locked room puzzle, and this wasn't scary as much as it was perplexing. If she had a mental puzzle to work on, her fears took a back seat. Face the problem. Look at it hard. What did she see? The message was painted on the top third of the wall, not the eyeline. The word was painted in blocky, sloppy capitals. The paint had run a bit, like a spooky horror font. She climbed back up on the bed next to Janelle and looked at the brushstrokes closely. There was something weird about how the paint ran down the wall.
"Look at how the drips all cut off at the same point," Stevie said, pointing. "Like a clean line."
Janelle leaned in to look.
"Someone wiped the paint," she said. "You can see the trace where they wiped it to keep it from dripping too much. How considerate."
Stevie gave a long exhale and stepped down.
"Let's check under the bed," she said.
They pulled the camp bed away from the wall. Stevie got down on the floor, examining it with her phone's flashlight, looking over every inch. She found two dead flies, a small piece of used tape, a leaf, a spider web, and then,
"Here,"
she said, pointing to a small spot of white paint.
"Look."
Janelle got down next to her.
"So the bed wasn't there when that message was painted on the wall," Janelle said.
"Exactly. This didn't happen last night unless we can sleep so soundly that someone can drag my bed away from the wall, set up some kind of stepladder, paint a message, and then push me back again."
"That makes it a little better," Janelle said, nodding. "At least someone wasn't in here with us. So what do we do now?"
"Well,"
Stevie sat on the edge of her squeaky camp bed.
"We can't tell Nicole about this. She doesn't really want us here, and she's definitely not going to like this, especially on the day the other counselors are coming. She might tell Carson we have to leave.
But I think we should make sure this place is secure. What if Carson could get us some plug-and-play cameras?"
Stevie pulled out her phone to text him.
"He'll be thrilled about this," she said grimly. She took a few pictures of the message and sent the texts. His reply came within a minute. We'll be there as soon as possible with cameras. Have something to show you.
Cameras are coming, Stevie said.
You shower and I'll stay here, then I'll go.
Janelle quickly gathered up her shower basket, towel, and clothes and headed off to get ready. Stevie went outside to sit on the tiny concrete porch of the cabin, hanging her legs over the side and letting her bare toes tickle the dirt. It was early, but she needed to make a phone call. To her surprise, David answered right away.
You're awake? She said.
Long drive today, he said. We left at 6. How's camp treating my princess?
Could be better, she said. Someone wrote the word surprise above my bed last night.
Is this some kind of sex joke?
No. Someone painted a message on our wall. It's the thing that was written at the crime scene in 1978.
Okay, David said, sounding maybe not so okay. First of all, are you all right?
It's fine, Stevie said, shielding her eyes from the bright morning sun. Just a prank.
Some fucking prank. What happened? They went into your cabin when you were out, or?
It's sort of more complicated than that, she said. We don't really know when they did it, except it wasn't while we were asleep. Somehow they did it before, and we only saw it when we woke up.
What?
She shook her head. It was complicated even if you were there, looking at it, and felt impossible to explain over the phone. Someone's playing a game, she continued. Maybe someone knows about me, about how at Ellingham someone left a message on my wall.
I don't want to keep bringing up what happened last time, but last time, that person was a murderer.
This feels different, she said.
Oh, good.
We're getting some security cameras. I don't know what happened, but I'm going to find out.
Yeah, I hate this, he said. How does this keep happening to... Scratch that. I know exactly how this keeps happening to you.
If Stevie was being completely honest with herself, and she preferred not to be, David's concern felt very good. He was really worried about her, possibly more worried than she was about herself. He cared. It sent warm bubbles of pleasure through her system. Then a voice broke through the haze of romantic bliss.
Welcome, counselors, Nicole said over the loudspeaker. Please bring your things to the dining pavilion.
I have to get ready and get going, she said.
Okay, but text me, call me, both. Let me know what's going on, okay?
I promise, she said. She couldn't help but break into a smile as she said it.
When Janelle returned, dressed in a flowing blue sundress, Stevie grabbed her things. The bathroom area was only a few yards away. The toilets and sinks were in a concrete and wood building, with no doors so the air and flies could get in without difficulty. The showers were wooden stalls outside of this main structure with no ceilings. It was basically a fancy hose and an open box, raised slightly off the ground to allow for drainage. Stevie would have much preferred it if the shower had been flush with the ground, because it seemed like a low, dark space under a shower would be an ideal spot for a family of snakes. Something had to live under there. She tried not to think about it. Though no one could see inside, it felt weirdly exposed to be able to see the sky and the trees above her as she undressed and showered. The water wasn't cold, but it wasn't warm either. It was already so muggy that it made no difference. She washed quickly, barely taking the time to rinse all the shampoo out of her hair. There were definite advantages to having short hair you cut yourself. All she needed to do was rub it a few times with her hand to dry and style it. She tugged on a shirt and a pair of black shorts, stuffed her feet back into her flip-flops, and took a leap out of the shower box to make sure the imaginary snakes couldn't bite her heels. When she returned to the cabin, Nate was there, sitting next to Janelle on the concrete step.
I heard, he said grimly. It's not a party until someone writes you a threatening message, is it?
You have your treehouse, Stevie pointed out.
I liked it better before you told me this, but yeah, I do.
We should go, Janelle said. I wish we could do more than just lock the door.
Stevie responded by reaching down and snapping off a blade of grass. She took it over to the door and slid it gently between the door and the frame, so that if the door was opened, it would be displaced.
People really do that?
Nate said. It works, she said. It'll do until we get the cameras.
Camp Sunny Pines was springing to life. The parking lot was full of cars, and their fellow counselors were unloading bags, greeting each other with big hugs and squeals, and taking pictures. It reminded Stevie of watching the second years at Ellingham greeting each other when she first arrived, a new student, knowing no one. She had Nate on one side of her now, and Janelle on the other. With them, and with David, she could do anything, even figure out how someone had snuck into their cabin and left a magically appearing message. Nicole and her assistant were greeting counselors and staff and checking them in. She gave them a terse nod and presented them each with a bag containing a reusable water bottle, sunscreen, a mini first aid kit, and a shockingly white camp t-shirt that she would never wear. Stevie was pleased to see that breakfast was being served and soon had a plate filled with pancakes, bacon, and sausage. Nate and Janelle got the same, but Janelle also accepted the cup of fruit because she cared about things like balanced meals. They had just sat down at a picnic table when Nicole approached them.
Fisher, she said.
Nate looked up from his sausage.
Small change of plan. One of the counselors got sick. He's going to be delayed by a day or two. I need you to sub in until he gets here.
What?
Nate said, blinking.
It's the Jackals, cabin 12. The kids are 9 years old. You'll be working with Dylan and staying in that cabin until the other counselor gets here. Can you go join him over at that table when you're done eating? And you'll be needed at group orientation this afternoon.
She indicated a guy who was two tables over who wore what looked like high-end surf clothing in bright yellow and blue. He was taking multiple selfies with a group of girls, lowering and raising his sunglasses for each one.
You two, she said to Janelle and Stevie, can begin set up in the art pavilion. You don't have to go to the afternoon session. That's for counselors working in bunks. You'll go to the campfire this evening.
She strode away, leaving a shell-shocked Nate.
Oh, no,
he whispered dryly.
No. How did everything fall apart so quickly?
Sounds like it's just for a day or two, Janelle consoled him.
A lot can happen in a day or two,
Nate replied. Considering how the morning had gone, Stevie was inclined to agree. 11. Stevie spent the morning not paying attention to the rules and safety walk and talk. She did not learn what to do in the case of a fire emergency at the campfire pit area. She did not learn where the lifeguard stations were along the lake. She paid no attention to where the first aid boxes were. As she walked, she mentally turned their cabin every which way, trying to work out how the message could be there and also not be visible. By the time the group headed to the dining pavilion for lunch, Stevie somehow managed to know less than she had when she'd started out that morning.
You didn't hear any of that, did you? Janelle asked her as they headed for lunch.
Stevie shook her head.
Me either.
Have you worked it out?
I haven't.
She shook her head again. Carson texted as they entered the dining pavilion, so Stevie peeled off and went to meet him in the parking lot. He was standing by the Tesla, shifting nervously from foot to foot.
You weren't the only one who got something,
he said.
Look at this.
He popped the trunk, which opened slowly. Inside, there was a plain cardboard box about the size of a shoebox, with the words, Open Me, Carson, written in black Sharpie. He opened the lid, revealing three dolls, one raven-haired girl, one plasticky boy, and one girl with red hair. They were bound in red string and had red slashes of paint all over them, and they were positioned exactly as Sabrina, Todd, and Diane had been found. They were all dressed in approximations of the clothes they'd been found in. The word surprise was written inside the lid.
I found this on my morning run,
he said, rubbing his hands together nervously.
It was in the middle of the path. It was on my property, but out of the range of the cameras.
Someone's done their homework, Stevie said. I got a message on my wall, like I got at Ellingham. And someone knows where you run and where the cameras are.
Yeah. And I'm the box guy who owns the camp where the Box in the Woods murders were, so they sent me a box.
By the last box, the word had lost all meaning for Stevie. She reached into her backpack and pulled out a nitrile glove. She had always been in the habit of carrying a few. It was probably a mockable trait until the Ellingham case, when they had come in handy on several occasions. She had actually brought them to camp in case she had to touch something gross. She snapped on a pair and carefully lifted the Sabrina doll out of the box. The shirt had the old Camp Wonderfalls logo painted on, and the hair had even been cut to resemble Sabrina's shoulder-length style. It wasn't a close match, but it was a good effort.
"Someone's trying to stop us from making this show," Carson said.
"Or someone's being an asshole," Stevie replied. "Still,
I don't think we go to the police with this," he said. "I don't know if these things are crimes, or if they are, they aren't serious ones. Criminal mischief or something. Is criminal mischief a thing? It sounds like a thing. Anyway, I don't think it's the kind of thing anyone is going to take very seriously. I think I pissed someone off last night. Here."
He handed Stevie a reusable bag in a very realistic fish scale pattern. Inside, there were half a dozen doorbell-sized cameras.
"Put them somewhere that Nicole can't see them," he said. "Otherwise, she'll start asking questions."
"Can I keep this?" she said, indicating the box of dolls. "I want Janelle to look at it. She's the craft expert."
"Sure," he said. "But be careful about..." "What am I saying? The police aren't going to dust this for prints."
"Probably not," Stevie said. "Unless one of us dies, I guess." Carson's eyes grew wide. "Kidding," she said. He went into the back seat of his car and produced a box full of reusable bags in dozens of different patterns and colors, all bundled into tidy little pockets.
"Take one to carry it," he said. "Or take as many as you want. I have a lot of bags."
Back at the dining pavilion, Janelle was being social and chatting with a group of people at one of the tables. Stevie headed for her. "Taking lunch to go," she said to Janelle. "Cameras to put up and something to show you." Stevie went to the food line and grabbed a hot dog and a soda. Ellingham had an ever-changing menu of organic, often vegan meals, with seltzer water on tap and maple syrup in every possible form. Sunny Pines did not have this kind of elegant variety. The menu appeared to consist of boiled hot dogs, boiled veggie dogs, hamburgers, veggie burgers, chicken nuggets, and a sad and lonely salad bar. As the former caretaker of a salad bar, Stevie felt for it, though it was not as complete as at the grocery store. This was some iceberg and salad mix, shredded carrots and ranch dressing. There was milk, water, soda, and sugary red bug juice to wash it all down. This was actually fine with Stevie. She would happily eat a hot dog every night for the entire summer, and she would guzzle bug juice and soda until all her teeth fell out of her head. Nate looked over anxiously as she passed by, like a drowning man. He was seated with Dylan, the other counselor, and a group of other new people. Stevie held up a hand of greeting and pointed, indicating that they were going back to their cabin. "Bag of cameras," she said, handing it over to Janelle when they got back to their cabin. "How quickly can we get these up?" Janelle examined the packages. "Give me 20 minutes, she said. "There's more," Stevie said, presenting the other bag to Janelle. "Carson found this when he went out for a run this morning."
"Oh, God," Janelle said.
"What? Stevie, this is messed up. It's crafty, though. Anything you notice about them?" Janelle grimaced but peered inside the box, then removed the Sabrina doll and examined the clothing. "Well," she said, pinching the material and looking at the stitching. "Looks like a pretty well-made doll outfit." She examined each doll in turn, checking cuffs and seams, looking inside and out. "No labels," she said. "I think these are custom-made."
"So someone would have to know how to sew."
"You can buy them," Janelle said. "Off Etsy or other places, people sell doll clothes. It would be easy enough to ask for a few outfits. The logo looks like it was painted on the shirt with fabric paint, and not very well. You could probably source all this stuff pretty easily. But why would you do this to us, and also to Carson?"
"Has to be the podcast."
There was a tinge of anger in her voice now.
"You seem mad," Stevie said.
"I am mad. We need to find the freak who did this."
"Cameras," Stevie said, taking the box of dolls and closing it up.
And you have to hide them as best you can so Nicole doesn't see them. Janelle picked up the bag and got to work. By the time Stevie had eaten her hot dog and drunk half her soda, Janelle had gotten out some industrial sticky strips and had the first camera attached under the light fixture by the door. She placed another one on the inside of the window with the hole in the screen, tucked in between the wrought iron guards. She got up on top of a dresser to put a third high up near the ceiling, pointed toward the inside of the door. She downloaded the app and had most of the setup complete by the 15-minute mark. She brushed off her hands and examined the feed for a moment, walking back and forth in front of each camera to ensure she was satisfied with the placement.
"That should cover all the angles," she said. "It's got smart detection, so we'll know if anyone comes in. Most of the other counselors are doing orientation games. We're the special ones, so we get to spend the day unpacking art supplies and setting things up. Apparently, supplies just arrived."
They headed over to the art pavilion, where Janelle stopped short.
"Oh my God,"
Janelle said when she saw the many piles of boxes.
"So much to unpack and put in order."
The joy in her voice couldn't be hidden.
"Do you need a moment alone?" Stevie asked.
"Maybe."
Janelle set about her dream job while Stevie set about to work on the problem. Stevie took the dolls out of the box and set them on the little table in front of her. Doll Sabrina, doll Diane, doll Todd. All slashed with red paint. This was easy and direct enough. The message on their cabin wall was different, clever. Since she didn't know how the ladder had been done, she switched over to asking why. Why leave the message? Why leave a box of murder dolls on Carson's running path? What would these things do? Well, cause fear. That seemed like the obvious answer. It would have taken time to get the dolls, time to make the outfits, time to do whatever it was that was done to their cabin. These things hadn't been knocked together in the short space of time between Carson's announcement last night and when they got back to the camp. Someone had been planning this for a few days at least. So someone knew she was coming and had taken the time to look her up. It was entirely possible that some people in town had gotten wind of Carson's plans before he announced them. Did they think this would stop the podcast from happening? There was no message attached to these things, nothing that said, "Stop making your podcast." Maybe it was a question of how. But the how still eluded her. How did you paint a message on a wall well in advance and have that message be invisible? She spent the next hour looking up paints, dyes, and invisible inks, but absolutely nothing turned up that explained how the thing could be done.
"It had to be something with the paint, right?" she said, coming up behind Janelle and startling her as she was organizing pipe cleaners by size and color. She pulled out her earbuds, leaking music out into the art pavilion.
"The paint," Stevie said, sitting down on the concrete floor opposite her.
"It had to be something with the paint, but I can't find any paint online that would do what we experienced. I think it was meant to freak me out."
"And me," Janelle added.
"Us out. But I mean, it also feels like a gift to me. It's an impossible puzzle. It's the kind of thing I'll obsess over."
"Maybe you have a fan," Janelle said. This had something to it. A fan? Some true crime creep who wanted to mess with the student sleuth. It didn't explain what had happened with Carson and his box, but it made a lot of sense in terms of the cabin.
"A fan," Stevie repeated.
"Someone wants to play? Then we'll play."
"Oh God, no."
Stevie's phone buzzed and she checked her texts. There was one from Nicole.
"Come to the dining pavilion," it read.
"I've been summoned," Stevie said. "If I don't come back, avenge me." She walked over to the dining pavilion with a vague sense of dread. Nicole was working on her laptop at a picnic table at one end.
"Someone wants to talk to you," she said. "She's over there."
Allison Abbott sat alone at one of the picnic tables at the far side, pensively tapping her chin with her fist. When Stevie approached, she looked up and straightened. Stevie braced herself. The relative of a victim had come here to chastise her. She felt sick, but walked on and sat down.
"Hey,"
Stevie said.
"Stevie," she replied.
I wanted to apologize for last night.
Stevie could not hide her surprise at this turn of events.
People always talk about this like it's some lurid slasher movie,
Allison went on.
I lost my sister. Some bastard took my sister from me. I feel like Carson used her memory, gave us that reading room to try to worm his way in. He can go to hell. But I didn't mean to catch you in the crossfire.
She leaned back a bit, taking Stevie in. Stevie was unsure what to do or say now that this announcement had been made. There was a heavy pause, full of the scent of boiled hot dog water.
Why did you come here? Allison asked.
Because I got a message that—
I mean here, to Barlow Corners, to this camp.
Carson clearly brought you here specially, which is why you were at the event last night and why he keeps introducing you to everyone as the girl from Ellingham Academy and as his partner in this project of his. I know what he wants.
Why did you come here?
Stevie considered her words carefully.
Because I want to—
Because people need answers. Because someone should do something. Allison cocked her head very slightly to the side. For a moment, she said nothing at all. Stevie felt a clammy nervousness brewing.
You know, Allison said, I remember so much about her. So many little details.
I remember sitting outside that summer, eating cherry twin pops. I rode bikes with her all over town.
She drove me to the roller rink and skated with me.
She helped me with my homework. And one of the last things I remember about that summer, right before she went off to camp, I remember sitting next to her in her room one afternoon while she played me Fleetwood Mac albums. She got up and wrapped a long scarf around herself and started doing a Stevie Nicks dance. She loved Stevie Nicks. She would have loved your name.
My name is Stephanie, Stevie replied. I've always been called Stevie. I don't know why, but I prefer it anyway.
Well, she said, she would have loved it. If she had lived, she would have been great at whatever she did. She would have done it all. She was one of those people, full of life. She was a force of nature.
She tapped her fingers on the plastic tablecloth. As it happens, I know Kyoko, your school librarian. We met at a library conference.
I got in touch with her last night, and she told me about you. She told me about what you did at Ellingham. I read up about it last night and this morning. It sounds like you do the work, like Sabrina did.
I talk to Sabrina all the time.
Well, I mean, I imagine talking to her. I think about what she would tell me to do. She would have said to give you a chance. I have to get back to the library. I'm busy all this week after work, but why don't you come over tomorrow morning? I have some things I'd like to show you.
Sure, Stevie said. Definitely.
I live on the far side of the lake. You can walk the path around, which takes a while, or if you take a bike, it's about 15 minutes. Here. She wrote her address on a napkin from one of the dispensers. Come at 6:30, she said. We'll have breakfast. I leave for my run at 7:30. You're welcome to run with me as well.
Stevie had not been expecting a 6:30 in the morning meeting time, but she nodded confidently as if that was how she always started her mornings.
Allison gave Stevie the address and left. Nicole watched this from the other end of the dining pavilion.
Everything all right?
She asked as Stevie passed. Her tone suggested that there was no way she thought that was the case.
Fine, actually, Stevie said, herself surprised.
Nicole seemed a touch disappointed. When Stevie returned to the art pavilion, she saw that Janelle had made a display of paint jars on the shelves. She had been joined by a sweaty and defeated Nate, grass stains on his shorts, his hair sticking up on top and slicked around his face with perspiration. He was resting on the smooth concrete floor and staring up at the ceiling.
What was that about? Janelle said.
Allison Abbott came to apologize. She wants me to come to her house in the morning to see some things.
Are you alive?
No, Nate said. And I heard your creepy message situation is now a creepy doll situation.
Have you worked it out yet?
Not yet, she replied.
I will. It'll come to me.
It did not come to her. It didn't come to her that afternoon, or over hamburgers around the campfire. Instead of socializing, she watched the feed from the cameras and picked at the problem in her head, finally going back to the cabin early. She approached with care, finding that she was unnerved by the shadows. She opened the door quickly to surprise anyone who may have been inside, but there was no one, as the cameras told her. She sat in the middle of the floor and looked up at the message, three quarters of the way up the wall, with its neatly wiped paint. She stared at it until her eyes went blurry. Then she groaned out a loud sigh and called David. He picked up immediately.
"I've been waiting for you to call," he said. "Everything okay?"
"Basically," she replied, rolling onto her stomach. "Still no idea who left the message. But whoever it was also left a box of creepy murder dolls outside of Carson's house, so I have that going for me."
David was quiet for a moment.
"You there?"
"Yeah," he said. "I know this is what happens to you, but I really don't like this. Are you okay?"
"I'm annoyed," she said. "I can't figure out how it was done. It's not possible."
"I was going to wait to take my time off," he said. "But how about I do it now? I'll ask for the week and then I'll go there. I could be there in a few days. There's a public camping site. I'm going to stay over there and camp, do some swimming, get in touch with nature."
Stevie felt a light floating feeling rising up from her heels, shooting through her spine and out the top of her head. David was coming. David was going to be here.
"Seriously?" "Yeah, seriously."
"When will you be here?" "Couple days," he said.
"A friend of mine is going to lend me her car."
"A friend? Who will lend you her car?"
"Jealous? You should be. She's hot. She's also 63 and has two grandkids, does yoga every day. She'd put my back out."
A feeling like warm, spreading sunshine crept over Stevie's body. She had a cold case. She had a locked room mystery. She had her friends, and now she would have David. In that moment, it was possible that Stevie had never been happier. 12. Stevie had an indifferent relationship with bikes. She knew how to ride one. At one point in her childhood, she had owned one. But she never really rode it, and the tires deflated, so her parents sold it at a yard sale. Bikes, however, were now her main mode of transportation. Allison Abbott may have been able to do the ride in 15 minutes, but for Stevie, it was a sweaty 45-minute ride around the dirt trails that said they were excellent for biking, but were actually uneven and pitted, and unexpectedly narrow at times with surprise rocks. Also, where Allison lived at the far end was almost entirely uphill. By the time Stevie arrived, it was almost 7 in the morning, which felt to her like a win. Judging from Allison's face when she opened the door, she did not feel the same way.
"I thought you would be here a bit earlier," she said, holding the door open for Stevie to come inside.
"Took a while."
"Would you like a drink?"
Stevie nodded heavily, sweat running down her face. Allison got her a large glass of water. As she gulped it back, Stevie took in her surroundings. This was a clean kitchen. It was more than that. This was a precise kitchen. The handles of the mugs on the shelf all faced the same way. The stainless steel fridge had no marks on the outside, and the inside, which Stevie saw momentarily, looked factory pristine. There was nothing extra on the counter, no weird piles of stuff, no random pieces of paper or notes. The dish sponge sat up straight like a soldier, drying in the optimal manner. There were clear containers of things like cereals and grains in an open pantry. This place had shades of Hercule Poirot, who always needed things to be of perfect size and in the right place.
"I wanted you to come here because I have something to show you," Allison said. "This way."
Stevie followed Allison into the hallway, which had dozens of carefully framed photographs of family and friends. At least a dozen were of Sabrina. Not one was crooked or unevenly spaced. Stevie followed on, up the carpeted stairs, past more framed photos. The house was like a gallery. There were Allison and Sabrina sitting side by side on a step, a black and white dog between them. Sabrina and Allison, the latter with a gap-toothed smile, opening Christmas gifts by a tree. Sabrina and Allison squinting into the sun at the beach. Sabrina and Allison by the lake. A whole wall of Sabrina Abbott, with her raven hair and big brown eyes, her wide open smile. Sabrina was beautiful, there was no question about it. There was a brightness to her, a determination that shone through the decades and the poor 70s photo quality that tinged the world in sepia. They passed by the open door of an immaculate, if slightly impersonal, master bedroom, and went to a closed door near the end of the hall. Allison opened this, and Stevie followed her into a darkened, smaller room that seemed to be a guest bedroom, except there was no bed. The walls were lined with packed bookshelves, and there were dressers and a rocking chair, but nowhere to sleep. Allison opened the curtains, and the room was suddenly airy and bright.
"Light can damage things," Allison said. "That's why I keep it so dark."
With the sun pouring in, Stevie had a better look at where she was. While this room was neat as a pin, nothing here was curated or impersonal. Every surface was absolutely full of old paperbacks and textbooks, yearbooks, notebooks, photo albums. One entire set of shelves was filled with vinyl record albums.